Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The Nintendo Entertainment System. Now, you're playing with power.
Don't kill me! Don't kill me, man! Don't kill me! Don't kill me, man!
I'm not going to kill you. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
In the simplest terms, the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain, and an athlete,
and a basket case, a princess,
and a criminal. Does that answer your question?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first episode of the Back in Time podcast, focusing on the year 1977. I'm your host, Curtis. With me, as always, with almost all of our, you know, products and programs and podcasts is Carlos.
Hello.
Fresh from whatever disaster he just recently averted.
Always averting disasters. It's just my life.
Yep. Aside from this newly christened midlife crisis or quarter life crisis that we've
I hope it's not my midlife crisis, because if I'm only living to, you know, that age, it's not gonna be very good.
No
quarter life crisis, that I can live with.
That you can live with. And joining us, I see we had these puns all lined up in the first time we recorded, and now they're already out the, you know, out of my mind. Let us introduce Laura from the Lettuce Podcast.
Hello.
This is the second time you've introduced yourself, so it's probably going to be like, what? I already introduced myself.
No, I feel very seasoned and I feel prepared for it. So, yeah.
I think that's the rule of thumb for all podcasts. You got to be ready for anything.
Oh, totally.
Laura, yes. Let us allow you to introduce your podcast, the Lettuce Podcast. Why don't you tell our listeners about it?
All right, so I am Laura of the Lettuce Podcast, and it is an all-female entertainment podcast where we cover everything from books to movies to television and music, any type of entertainment that we deem appropriate. Every 2 weeks, we release a topic episode about something specific, a movie or a series, book, whatever. And in between, we have shorter, more conversational episodes where my co-host Charlotte and I talk about our lives and the entertainment that we've been enjoying recently. We play a lot of games, we drink a lot of drinks, and we have a lot of fun. We're super huge entertainment nerds.
The drinking while podcasting is definitely something we share in common.
Oh, totally.
Also, too, I was listening to one of your podcasts, and
oh, yeah?
I always thought like the Mary Boff Kill thing was something kind of unique to our podcast. At least that's what our listeners had us believe. But then I'm like, wait, they do the Mary Boff Kill thing too. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's our favorite game to play. And we actually play Kill Mary Pity Date is what we call it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Used to have a third host, and now she just she serves as a guest every so often because she went back to school, so she didn't have as much time to hang with us. But we actually adapted it from Boff Mary Kill, as you call it, because she's not super interested in sex, so she wanted it to be more applicable to her life. So we changed it to Kill Mary Pity Date, which is fun and silly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people are going to be listening to this podcast wondering what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really, this podcast is sort of like a limited run.
It's about time travel.
It's about time travel, yeah.
Are you Dr. Who?
I may have a sonic screwdriver in my pocket, yes.
Yay. We have two in our house.
I can't confirm or deny. I was watching that show, Legends of Tomorrow, and I realized that somebody that was on Doctor Who was on that show, and I was like, wait, what?
Huh?
Yeah. Like, maybe there is a connection there. This podcast is going back to the year 1977, which is the year that Star Wars came out, and, you know, obviously a lot of other things. We're basically going to go year by year, what came out, what was influential. That word was in there somewhere, as well as, you know, what basically, you know, was controversial, and, you know, kind of trace nerdom back to its beginnings, which I know there's probably more before Star Wars, but I think Star Wars in 1977 was where, you know, everything sort of began. And, you know, my plan for this is to actually have guests like Laura on every week from each podcast or different podcast to basically expand, you know, our listeners' understanding of other podcasts. And, you know, I think it's always good too, because I think the misconception is that, you know, podcasts are always, you know, competing against each other for iTunes rankings and whatever else, but it's not the case.
No way, man.
We work together, man. We're like the Avengers. We come together. We might, you know, have a few spats along the way, but, you know,
totally. Work together. Work with the guy that podcasts with his cat. Are we ever going to work with that guy? Is he invited to our team?
No, he's been barred.
Is he one of our podcast enemies?
Well, he's not an enemy. He's just kind of like, dude, I don't think you work with humans well. You work only well with cats, so no.
Talks to his cat for a whole podcast.
Yeah, I don't think he would work well with us, Carlos. I mean, I'd have him on if he could prove that he could talk to people and not just cats, but I'm not too sure about that. And
I really wish I knew what you guys were talking about.
Oh, this is a bit of an in-joke, because
okay,
when our podcast first started, I was checking rankings and seeing where we were at. And one of the first times I checked the rankings, there was a podcast below ours, and it was called Cat Chat.
Oh, like, no.
That's weird. What's this podcast about? So I just listened to an episode, and it was literally a guy just talking to his cat, and his cat was meowing back to him. And that was, it was basically 45 minutes to an hour of that. And it was a very special thing. So wow. We always kind of bring it up occasionally as, hey, there was always that podcast with the guy talking to his cat.
Part that's of our totally mythology.
The funny thing is I kind of checked and I couldn't find it anymore. So I wonder if he was just, you know, done with it. Didn't want to share his life with his cat. But let's get into 1977. I have it broken down into three of the major things that kind of came out in that year. Movies and music and TV shows. We'll start with movies. And one that I think almost all of us are aware of is Star Wars. Which, at the time, it was just Star Wars, but now it's known as Episode 4, A New Hope.
Mm-hmm.
Once they started to add sequels and retcon it with the Clone Wars and all that. But, you know, I think it's hard for a lot of us to kind of, you know, imagine that time where that movie came out and, you know, there wasn't VHS, there wasn't any home video. You know, if you wanted to watch that movie, you had to go see it in theaters. Otherwise, you were SOL.
Totally.
I also think, too, it's probably the most fun of the Star Wars movies. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I might discredit my nerddom here by saying I'm a very casual fan of Star Wars. However, okay. The thing that I really connect with Star Wars and that really amazes me about Star Wars as a franchise is that it totally and completely revolutionized the movie-going experience. It made it communal. It made people want to go and do this thing together, either with friends they know or with strangers, and I think that's super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She has a huge point there, because, I mean, I think that's why it made sense to start with this year, because, like, again, like, nerddom didn't start with Star Wars, but Star Wars was what made it exactly as she said, like a communal experience, right? Like it helped create that community. And I mean, part of that had to do with what was going on in youth culture at the time in like the late 70s and how youths of that time, they needed something to connect them as a group. And Star Wars was one of the huge cultural forces that did that, right? So it like came along at just the right moment. It's awesome.
Yeah, no. And I mean, obviously a lot of big stars came from the movie, including Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford. I mean, less so Carrie Fisher. She sort of fizzled out, I guess. But
those Blues two Brothers and done.
She's like, you know what? I've got my money. I don't need to do anything. I think she has this weird-looking dog, too, that like she just spends her whole time with. So, you know, she's probably like totally content with that. And obviously, too, I mean, this was a technically, not really technically, but this was a movie that really was saved in editing, as George Lucas infamously has said. Like, he shot everything and he was not too happy, and he basically salvaged what he could in editing. And, you know, obviously Star Wars is what it is now, but it's kind of funny to think of movies nowadays going into shoot and, you know, the directors and the writers and all that have a very clear vision of what they want to do with the film. Back then, George Lucas was just like, I've got a bunch of stuff. I have no clue how I'm going to connect it all together. Hopefully this works. It's kind of, you know, crazy to think, especially with how popular Star Wars is.
It's and amazing sort of like that he came up with something that worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
the fact that it feels so complete, like, as a film, and it, like, it just works on every single level, especially because, I mean, like, you know, I was huge into, like, those behind-the-scenes documentaries and, like, other sort of, like, stuff that, like, exposés that people have done on, like, sort of the production of Star Wars, and about how, again, like, every single step of making that goddamn movie was a disaster, right? And like you said, it's sort of like the editing room, like, the original cuts of it were just so bad, and it was only salvaged by, you know, the post-production team. And you're like, the fact that it turned into something that is, that works so well on every level as a film is just, you know, a miracle.
Also, too, I've heard a lot of stories about how Harrison Ford didn't like the script and actually improvised a lot of lines, like one of which was the intercom scene when he's, or when him and Luke are trying to find Leia, like that whole dialogue with the intercom Imperial officer was all basically just Harrison Ford just improvising that. And I think that, you know, obviously the prequel movies kind of later went into this very rigid structure, but it's kind of nice to see that, you know, back before the whip was whipped, so to speak, you know, they had a lot more fun basically just doing what they thought made sense for those characters. Yeah. What's your favorite moment from Star Wars? Start with Laura.
Oh boy, I'm not sure I could choose one. No. I'm a big C-3PO person. Well, as big as you can be for someone who identified as a casual Star Wars fan. So any time where he's kind of like bugging out, I really enjoy.
But it's kind of, he's kind of like that character because everyone else has so much confidence and bravado, and he sort of levels everything off by being this completely, you know, insecure droid who just is like, oh man, we could totally all die right now.
I love comic relief, and he's super great for that.
Yeah. Carlos?
Can I cheat and have two? Or am I not allowed?
I'll allow it.
Okay. Well, then the one would have to be just that, honestly, that opening shot with the Star Destroyer chasing the Tantive IV. Just because, I mean, I've talked about that shot before on Doom's Domain and how well it works as like a piece of visual storytelling, but it's just a brilliant shot. And then the other one, sort of like as a moment, is Luke and this was like the super iconic moment, was Luke and Leia swinging over that crevice in the Death Star. Oh man, still gets every time. I'm like, whoa, adventure.
I think for me, it's the attack on the Death Star, the trench run.
Oh yeah,
because when you really think about it, that movie leading up to all of it, it was a lot of build up, but just how they delivered on it. I mean, a lot of movies since have been able to deliver on having this great action scene, but I think Star Wars really laid that groundwork of having this great final action set piece. I mean, again, I know other films have done this, but I think Star Wars really just made it as big of a thing as it eventually became. Like, you look at movies like The Avengers and all that, where, you know, they build up to this big action set piece that takes like 30 minutes, and everyone's like, oh, that's so great. You know, you can take probably 5 minutes of that last 30 minutes and make a trailer out of it, and people are totally loving that movie, right? So, yeah, no. I mean, I know it's totally, you know, fandom, you know, bursting from the seams, but yeah, no, totally a lot of fun. Speaking of other sci-fi films that came out in 1977, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Kind of a different sci-fi movie.
Anybody but another classic.
Yes. And it's funny, too, because George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, you know, they've been close friends for many years. It's just kind of funny that both had movies come out in 1977. I mean, obviously, Close Encounters did very well and was very well received, but there's no way it could ever do the amount of success that Star Wars had. So,
yeah, it was very well received, but it was expected that, like, it was sort of going to be doing better than Star Wars, because nobody saw Star Wars coming.
I mean, you know, whenever I watch Close Encounters, I always like, there's certain times that I think Richard Dreyfuss looks like Chris Pratt, and I'm like, wait, is Chris Pratt in this movie? No, can't be. But, yeah, no, I mean, definitely, I think Close Encounters is sort of the benchmark that a lot of people go to when you hear about Steven Spielberg doing a sci-fi film. I mean, there's certainly, you know, the element of the kids and the sense of wonder and all that. I mean, they obviously built on that with E.T. down the road and whatnot, but I think Close Encounters is sort of where that template was made. Has it been long since either of you have seen the movie, or...?
It's been a while since I saw it, but I do get what you're saying, because, I mean, like, it was more of that sort of, like, what is it? Like, sort of, like, inspired, sort of, like, cerebral sci-fi, like, exploring ideas.
Yep.
Feel. And a lot of movies have, since then, have taken big cues from Close Encounters in terms of, like, how it lays its groundwork and its narrative and other such things. Sort of, like, more methodically paced film.
Mm-hmm. Speaking, sorry.
Go ahead. I was just gonna say, like, I haven't seen this movie in a couple of years, but it's a classic movie and it's got really iconic scenes and lines, and it gets referenced a lot in TVs and other movies since then.
Yes.
And I'm a musician, so when they're using solfege to teach the melody to communicate with aliens, that's the best for me.
You're like, music will be the savior of all mankind down the road.
Absolutely it will.
I will have to agree with that. I'll have to keep that in mind, too. If someone's ever like, hey, Curtis, how are we going to communicate with these aliens? I'll be like, music.
Solfege.
Yep. Call Laura. She's the expert on this.
Yes, I can teach you solfege.
Now we know.
I know a couple Weezer songs, but I don't know if the aliens want to hear that. It might actually turn them away. Like, really?
Depends on what they like.
Yeah, it's true.
If it's early Weezer, they'll probably be cool.
Yeah, they'll be like, oh, Pinkerton? Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Go check them out. Going from one movie set in kind of like a desert community-esque, I guess, to another, The Hills Have Eyes, kind of a seminal horror film from the 70s. I think it was Wes Craven's debut, if I'm not mistaken, or at least one of his...
This was like his second or third movie. It was before he did, obviously, Nightmare on Elm Street, which was like, you know, put him on the map huge. But this is like, was a big part of his development as a director.
Yeah. I mean, most of us probably know the remake that came out in like 2007, but...
I thought it was 2006, but yeah, like it's around there.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're probably around that time frame, right? But yeah, I mean, obviously Wes Craven, he's a horror icon. And I've tried to watch this movie. I don't think I was able to get through it just because I'm thinking, like, man, it's starting to show its age a little bit, you know? But I think it's a good movie. I think it's just, it's not one that's aged well. I don't know. Have either of you seen it and have any memories of it?
I have never seen it, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Horror is not really my thing, so.
I will say that I probably can agree with that, because, I mean, like, it's technically, like, well done. Like, he was sort of doing what he could with what he had. And again, like, this was still, like, his developmental phase as a director. But in terms of, like, how it's overall, like, constructed, like, he's obviously, he had way better work ahead of him. And it's sort of difficult to go back to The Hills Have Eyes as, like, sort of, like, a horror experience outside of just sort of looking at it as, like, this historical artifact and being all like, hey, look, this is what Wes Craven was doing before people cared about Wes Craven.
Yeah. And what I think is interesting is he's always kind of been a director to, you know, hear a new story or whatever, and obviously he twists it into whatever horror movie he can make, but I think it's always kind of interesting with him that he always seems to have this, you know, kind of not too strong link, but a bit of a tenuous link with reality with his horror movies. And I think that The Hills Have Eyes, I think when we say it was based on a true story, it wasn't really, but I think, you know, he must have read a news story somewhere and was like, hey, you know what, I think this will make for a good horror movie. That's it.
It's yeah, based on a true story in the same way Titanic is.
Yes. Where it's like you have an event that happened, but then you're just like, all right, now let's fill it with all kinds of crazy stuff.
Rose and Jack just show up in the middle and they're like, I think we're in the wrong movie.
Like, this is not what was supposed to be happening here.
See, now I just want to re-edit lots of movies and just have Rose and Jack swing in for a minute and see what happens.
There you go. Make it into a meme.
Any movie with water scene, it would be perfect, right? Like a little pond, you just show them drowning. It's like, wait, it's a little pond.
Not being able to share that door that was definitely big enough for both of them.
Yeah, I think when the movie came out, nobody really touched on it. I love how, at least for Titanic, that's become a thing now in recent years, right?
Yes.
It's a huge talking point for people. They're like, they even asked, like the, like everybody that had ever been involved in that movie. It's like, what do you think about this? They're like, oh my God, let's talk about something else.
It was on Mythbusters.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
That's probably where this whole renaissance of the movie and the reality of it kind of sprung from. Going from reality to a twisted, very odd version of reality, Eraserhead, also came out in 1977, directed and written by David Lynch, who, he's never really followed the Hollywood structure. He's always done his own little odd thing, and this movie is definitely a sign of what he wants to do with his career. Have either of you ever seen the movie? I know it's a deeper cut for a lot of people.
I've seen it, but it's been a while.
I still just remember, like, because, you know, the whole point, the whole kind of thing about that is that, you know, Henry Spencer kind of has all these things going on in his life, but the real, you know, really odd point is that he's got this, like, just mutant baby that you know, he's now looking after. I think, like, I don't know, like, I remember seeing that, and I was a teenager, I wasn't too young. I remember that gave me nightmares, that, like, little mutant baby child he had. I'm like, what the heck? That thing's so just disgusting. No.
I remember being thoroughly creeped out by it.
Yeah. And that's the thing with David Lynch, is he always tries to, you know, throw in this really odd element, but otherwise it might seem a little surreal, but have this, again, tenuous link to reality. I think that's probably a theme going on in 1977.
Yeah.
I think surreal is the word.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, that's basically those movies in a nutshell, right? David Lynch. I mean, what else did he do? He did, Twin Peaks Down the Road and a few other movies. Mulholland Drive.
Yes.
Kind of all following in the same sort of structure.
He just loves to test limits, and it's good. It works for him.
I think, you know, he took a few risks early on and people liked it. And now he's like, oh, wait, people actually like when I do this crazy stuff? Okay, I'm just going to keep doing that then.
Yeah.
Going from something surreal or surreal to Saturday Night Fever, which
all right,
very much iconic. Carlos, are you just walking down the aisle right now?
Sorry, I had that ready.
I'm honestly not surprised that you had that ready.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
A list of movies. I was like, okay, I have to have this ready for when we do that.
Now, I'm just gonna say, not a great film, not even a good film, but obviously influenced a lot of style and music of the era.
You don't like?
I don't like Saturday Night Fever. I don't think it's a really good movie.
It's fun. It might not be the most well put together put thing, but it got a lot of acclaim when it first came out. So
I think just looking at it now, it almost kind of plays like an ad for, you know, the clothing and music of the time. That's just me. I feel, but
yeah, I think it's not a masterpiece and it's not a work of art, but I think it's fun and it does really kind of capture a time in American history. And I do think it's interesting that it seems like it's just like a silly movie about dancing, but it does kind of touch on some deeper problems with race issues and subculture and things like that. But again, not necessarily a work of art.
No. But of course, you know, people saw that movie when it came out, and it, you know, this is around the disco era, so people were just, you know, there's always the stories of after this movie coming out, people were always trying to emulate Travolta style in that movie, you know, the white jacket and the slick back hair and all that, you know, until Scarface came out, and then that look kind of just got revitalized again.
Whoops.
It was so much for that, eh?
Yeah.
Now, going on to a franchise that existed long before 1977.
I'm so excited about this.
I know, same here. I mean, I like Star Wars. I like Close Encounters. Eraserhead definitely is up there for me. But The Spy Who Loved Me, definitely one of the odder James Bond films. But I think again, it's a product of its time, right? But
I'm pretty sure the entire Roger Moore era was odd.
It was. Yeah.
I mean, you had the car that could go underwater. That was a huge... I think, like, everyone knows about that part from the movie.
Yes.
The Jaws, which are cute.
Jaws. Jaws is my favorite henchman.
Yeah, he... I mean, I think it's kind of one of those funny things where there's so many iconic, you know, things from this film that people often forget. Like, people are like... A lot of people actually write off Roger Moore. I'm not the biggest fan of him as... in terms of, like, Bond actors, but I think it's hard to deny, like, how much, you know, this film contributed to the overall mythos of James Bond.
I agree. Roger Moore's not my favorite Bond, but I think this is his best movie, and this is my favorite of the classic Bond films. So, I don't know, I love this movie. It's, like, for me, the right amount of ridiculousness for a James Bond movie.
Yes.
And I thought it was actually made pretty well, considering the time and the story that they were dealing with.
I think, like, oh, can I just, like destroy the entire planet and live under the water, please?
Yes.
Try me, please.
On my base, named Atlantis.
Totally subtle. I also remember, too, like, I think the film opens with him having sex with a woman in a cottage or something. Like a fur rug or something, which is
It was because he's in, like, I don't know, because, you know, so many Bond movies have fucking ski set pieces, right? And it was all about, what is it, because, like, he was having sex with some agent, and then, like, he killed the other agent who was the one who was in love with the agent who ended up being the main Bond girl.
He kills her husband.
Yeah.
Which, right? He does that a lot.
He does that. Like, it's just like this weird convoluted opening, but it's just like, it's that's Bond, though.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure if James Bond were to murder me and take my wife, I'd be totally fine with it.
Be like,
it's James Bond.
It's sort of his thing.
He could explain it away.
Yeah. I always remember, too, the infamous ski jump scene.
Yes.
Which is... You know, I think a lot of people, when they want to look at, you know, real practical effects and not just CGI, that's definitely one of the crazier effects that, you know, now we look at and we say, well, there's no way you could do that CG and make it look realistic. I mean, the way they did it is just crazy. And I heard the guy that did it, like, I heard he suffered injuries. I'm not too sure if that's all rumor it from where
I don't
stand.
Recall.
Annie Hall. I guess the seminal romantic comedy movie, I guess.
This is one I haven't seen, unfortunately. I feel kind of embarrassed to say.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Carlos, have you seen Annie Hall?
Yeah, it's that fucking movie that stole Best Picture from Star Wars.
No, sorry, buddy.
Sorry, Carlos.
I'm still mad, because I had to watch it to be like, okay, what is this? And I watched it, and I'm like, oh, okay.
It's a pretty good film. I mean, it really does analyze, you know, relationships and, you know, personalities. And it's actually kind of funny because that movie, or sorry, the series that's out on Netflix now, I think it's called Love.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that Judd Apatow comedy. Like, it kind of reminds me a bit of Annie Hall, where you have, you know, like the neurotypical guy and the more free-spirited woman. I mean, Annie Hall sort of set that kind of trend in motion. I mean, I know people play on that in various ways, you know, switching around the different roles and types of personalities and all that, but I think in terms of Woody Allen movies too, it's probably my favorite of his films.
I know it's his most iconic film, I would say. I
mean, yes.
Yeah.
I did like Midnight in Paris, and I think there was one where, I forget the name of it, maybe one of you might know what I'm talking about, but, oh, actually, I just remember now, The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's definitely one of his lesser-known movies, but I really enjoy that movie. So, Carlos, you're just like, I don't like this movie because it stole Star Wars.
Okay, it's not bad. It's like, it's fun,
okay.
But I was just like, because the thing was, I hadn't seen it before I learned that that was what, because again, like, Star Wars did get a nomination that year, but yeah, it lost to Annie Hall. And so I, like, as someone, I was like, okay, I have to go back and see what this movie is. Right, and I watched it, I'm like, oh, okay, this is fine. So I don't hate it. It was just sort of like, that's sort of like what I remember it for.
Yeah. Now, Carlos, you're going to have a lot to talk about this next film, The Rescuers.
Hey, it's The Rescuers.
Yes. So I know you were talking about The Rescuers Down Under a couple weeks ago. So when I was looking it up, I'm like, wait, that movie came out in 1977. I'm like, well, I have to put that on the list just so Carlos can, you know, talk about how much he loves it.
Well, I don't love it that much. I mean, it's good, but The Rescuers Down Under blows it out of the water. But for, like, a movie that was made at that time, because, I mean, like, this was, like, a weird time for, what is it, like, the Disney Animated Classics line, because they were sort of in, like, this transition phase between the, like, their classics, like their old school classics that did really well, and then their super happy Renaissance era when they really started to kick things up again. Like, it's not like they were making bad movies at the time, but they weren't seeing as much success as they were back then, and they would be later on, right? So The Rescuers came out, and I mean, it worked for what it was, as, like, again, like this sort of, like, you know, like mystery, sort of like, how do we get this kid back from this crazy bitch who kidnapped her movie. But when you compare it to when you watch The Rescuers Down Under and sort of like that sense of adventure that that movie has, the first one really doesn't have that at all. And it sort of sucks, even though you know, it does have some nice moments. They really improved on it with the second one. So
yeah, it's interesting to note too that in the 70s animation kind of took an interesting turn. I mean, not to say that the lighthearted children's animation totally went away, but you had sort of this kickback of more adult-geared animation comedies coming out. I mean, I infamously remember Fritz the Cat as just being this, you know, completely raunchy, completely, you know, not for kids at all animated movie. And, you know, it was kind of good that eventually Rescuers came out and kind of showed that, yeah, you know, these movies are still for kids, guys. This is not all for adults. As much as I like Fritz the Cat, and I kind of wish there was a bit of a, you know, renaissance for that character. But that's it for movies, I guess. Let's move on to music. Rumors from Fleetwood Mac, probably my favorite album from 1977. I feel like, Laura, you're going to probably agree with me on that.
Yes, I am definitely going to agree. Absolutely. Yes. Best album from 1977.
A lot of behind-the-scenes drama for that record, but, man, it's hard to argue with the end product, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing to me is, like, this is the ultimate breakup album. There is no better breakup album than this one. And they will not admit that that's what it's about. Like, they just deny that all of these great works of art came out of the fact that they were all dating each other and all broke up at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that, yeah, you know, they had so much behind the scenes drama that eventually, yeah, they just, you know, started to put their sorrow and their anger into songs. But it's kind of funny because, like, I know a lot of those songs sort of get, like, misconstrued. I mean, a lot of those songs kind of get put into movies nowadays, and I don't think people fully understand the meaning behind the songs.
Agreed.
Like, I infamously remember, like, Forrest Gump put, like, what's the song, like, You Can Go All the Way?
Go Your Own Way.
Go Your Own Way, yeah. And, like, it's set when Forrest is just running across the country, and I'm like, this is totally not what the song's about, but
whatever. I remember when Bill Clinton was running for president in the 90s, he used Don't Stop as his campaign song, and it's a breakup song. It's about, like, going separate ways with someone, and I was like, this is not what you want. You want us to want to vote for you.
Breaking up with the entire nation.
Yeah, I was, you know, like, 7 or whatever when that was happening, and I understood this.
Like, hey, something's not quite right here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I think the band, too, I mean, they had some success afterwards, but nowadays. I mean, I remember because I live in Vancouver, and I remember they came through town, and I saw them, and it was definitely not what I was expecting to see. I think I had higher expectations of seeing them live, and I was just like, "You have not aged well." Sorry.
No, they're all a little worse for the wear, I think.
Yeah. Well, we can always remember Rumors for being just that great album.
Oh, God, it's so good.
It is. And listeners, I know you've got something in your ears right now, but when you're done, go listen to Rumors.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays with Spotify and all that, too, I mean, it's so easy. You can just go online, search it up, listen to it.
I actually have a copy on vinyl.
What?
I do.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Laura, your cred just jumped up by,
Thank you.
She did say that music was her thing, so I mean,
Oh, that's true.
It's actually have not mine.
I actually have the next album we're going to talk about on vinyl, too.
Okay, because this is another great album, too. You may notice that I have put this in order of albums Curtis likes most to least.
Oh, okay. Well,
not really to least. I mean, they're all good, but Eric Clapton's Slow Hand. Man, such a great album as well. I mean, he's kind of an artist who's always reinvented himself throughout the years. I mean, he had that slower acoustic period, I guess, later on in his career. You know, Slow Hand, I guess, is kind of like, I think for me, like, that era of Clapton that I enjoy the most. And I know everyone sort of has an album of his that they kind of find more in tune. Like, I know a lot of people liked his MTV Unplugged album that he did. But, yeah, Slow Hand for me. I mean, a lot of, I guess, well-known Clapton songs came from the album.
Yeah, Cocaine and Wonderful Cocaine. Tonight.
Cocaine, such a great name for, you know, a song. I mean, the funny thing is, too, is, you know, he could have named it anything else to sort of be a little bit more subtle about it, but I like that he was just like, nope, this song's about cocaine.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not very Beatles-y to just go right for it, but he's not the Beatles, so.
Yeah, that's true. He's no John Lennon.
No.
Next up is Pink Floyd's Animals, sorry. Again, not an album I got really into. I'm not even that big of a Pink Floyd fan, but I know a lot of people who are. So I'm not trying to, you know, say that Pink Floyd's terrible, guys. Don't email us at 3andGreenNerdsPodcast@gmail.com letting us know why I'm so wrong. But I don't know. I mean, I never got into Pink Floyd, but I know that in 77, it was a big hit. I think, you know, when you listen to the soundtracks of a lot of movies that came out in subsequent years and all that, Pink Floyd definitely was influential during that time.
Oh, I agree. And I kind of agree with everything you're saying. Like, I'm aware of Pink Floyd. I know some of their songs, but I'm not a huge fan of theirs, so I'm not really, really familiar with the album. But similar to what I was talking about with Star Wars, I give a lot of credit to Pink Floyd because they also, in a way, kind of revolutionized the concert-going experience by, you know, all of this visual stuff that they've added to it. They're much more theatrical than the average rock show is. And I think that's really impressive and really innovative. So they have a place, I think.
Well, I know, too, that, you know, obviously concert, you know, VHS and DVD started to become a thing. And I think Pink Floyd was really the band that really made that a thing. I mean, I know there's a lot of other bands that, you know, had those made as well, but Pink Floyd, yeah, you're right. They had so much of a visual element that you could capture that on film, and that translated just as well to on film as it did to the album itself.
Oh, yeah.
And then just going to our last major record we're talking about, I guess, in 1977 was AC/DC's Let There Be Rock. Because it's AC/DC. I mean, I enjoy their music. I think as I've gotten older, I've sort of lost my appreciation for it. But I think if you asked like 15-year-old me about AC/DC, he would totally be all over it.
15-year-old Curtis would just be like, Kylo Ren loved their leader. He loves AC/DC.
Wait, when I'm 15, I know about Kylo Ren. This is some next level meta stuff here, Carlos.
Wait, dude, you are the doctor. Go back in time. If it's a time traveling podcast, all bets are off, man.
That's true. What you're going to find out, listeners, is I went back to 77 to do my research. I didn't go to Wikipedia or anything. I just got in my time machine, my back. Any thoughts on Let There Be Rock?
I'm just listening and learning because, again, music is not my thing. Like, I've heard some of this stuff before, but, like, I couldn't even tell you, like, what songs are attached to which albums. I'm just sort of, like, I'm a graceful student.
Carlos is notoriously into movie soundtracks and soundtracks.
And video game soundtracks.
Yeah. But you're not really much into, like, you know, actual musicians and whatnot.
It's not that I have anything against them, and I've listened to lots of music from, because again, I'm weird. What I usually will do is that I'll find like one song per artist that I like, but I can't call myself a fan of like the artist or band as a whole because like I don't pay attention to all of their stuff. Right. Regular music industry, I am super, super casual and distant.
Carlos, I feel like you would really like Rumors from Fleetwood Mac. I feel like that would be a good album for you to check out.
I bet you if I go listen to it, I'd be like, I've heard some of this stuff before, but I'll be like, I couldn't name any of it if you asked me to.
You've definitely heard songs from Rumors before.
Oh, yeah. It's inevitable. Mm-hmm. Also, too, Carlos, I'm pretty sure Guardians of the Galaxy Awesome Mix Volume 1 probably had a song on there from around this time.
Well,
I could kind of count.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because when Guardians of the Galaxy came out, Carlos and I were all over that Awesome Mix.
I listened to it minimum once a week.
Yeah.
I was listening to it several times a day, but because I'm weird.
No, I went through that too, like when I first got it, and because I work at a job where I can listen to music all day, so there was a span of time where I just listened to it on repeat for days.
Yeah, because it's kind of funny. It's not really a soundtrack. It's more of a mixtape more than anything, but it's pretty good.
And it is awesome.
Yes. Final little segment is our TV show segment. There wasn't a lot of TV shows that debuted this year. Of the three that we're going to talk about, this one did not be overly successful. But I think for our audience, they'll be the most interested in the Amazing Spider-Man TV series. God.
This show...
It's pretty bad. I mean, when you look at it now, it's bad.
It's hilarious to go back to and look at, but not very well together.
I mean, the costume, I find the costume not too bad. I mean, I guess for me, I'm thinking of it from the sense of, you know, when it came out at the time, it was not too bad. The actor that they got to play Peter Parker, Nicholas Hammond, he was pretty good.
Better than Andrew Garfield, but it's not that hard.
No. It only was on for 2 seasons, so it did not last as long as it probably could have or should have. But I think it's interesting, too, because I know there was a lot of comic book properties being adapted. And obviously, you know, on our other podcast, Three Angry Nerds, we sort of talk about this, you know, in the recent... you know, time frame of things, but it's interesting to go back and watch this and see, you know, where these live action adaptions came from. And
I'm looking at some pictures, like screenshots of it right now. It looks like it was interesting.
Yes.
It's like I said, it's not that good, but it is fascinating to go back and watch it nowadays and be like, oh my gosh, you know, you realize like how far, like how, sort of like how far back live-action superhero adaptations really go, right? I mean, like, they did exist back then. Although, again, what was weird was that there were several Spider-Man adaptations. Like, this wasn't the only one. Like, there was also, what is it, the one in Japan that was also live-action and was so weird and screwed up. And I don't know exactly the timeline and when that was being done. But there were a couple Spider-Man adaptations that for some reason just did not use characters outside of like really like Spider-Man. Like there were some supporting characters in this show, but like for the most part, like villains just like from that you recognized in the comics were just not present. And like, it just didn't feel like it was much of an adaptation outside of just having Spider-Man jumping around on your screen. So,
interesting too. I mean, we'll talk about this more next week when we talk about The Incredible Hulk, because it kind of debuted in 1978, but it also had the two-part origin story in 1977. So I thought I'd mention that, because I literally just found out about that. But, on to the next TV show that actually, you know, had a pretty successful run with Three's Company. I mean, probably not everyone's cup of tea, but you have to remember that back then that almost every TV show was a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know now the sitcom is sort of something that's dying out. I mean, not to say that it's completely gone, but there's definitely less and less of them as we go more towards the serialized shows and all that. But
I feel like there's more sort of like cultural contempt for sitcoms, especially sort of like ones that are very traditional and don't break many of the tropes. Like, it's sort of become, like, they've sort of become a joke, which is funny because they're supposed to be a joke, but it's, they've sort of like become, they've earned a lot of ire, I feel, like a lot of scorn from the general fan base.
Yeah.
These days.
Well, yeah, it's the multi-cam sitcoms are basically dead now. And I don't, I think it's kind of more of, we're moving into a culture where we like our entertainment to be more believable, or if it's something that's not necessarily believable, something that could kind of fit into our lives as we know it. And the reason why the multi-cam sitcom, in my opinion, doesn't work there is they usually are just too grandiose and too out there to be believable or just be applicable to life.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of funny, too, because like Rumors, which we were just talking about, there's definitely some behind-the-scenes drama for this show, which I find interesting. Also, too, I think that, you know, of course, yeah, you, as you say, there's a contempt now for sitcoms, but I think in the 70s and 80s even, too, they tackled a lot of issues that at the time were not being tackled. And I think now we take for granted that, you know, shows like Game of Thrones and all that will tackle very serious issues almost nonchalantly. But for a show in the 70s to bring up, like, abortions and stuff like that, I mean, back then it was very taboo to do. And obviously a lot of these shows, Three's Company included, definitely was not afraid to be like, hey, we're going to tackle this and we're going to, you know, make this something that people are aware of.
Yeah, I mean, the whole premise of the show is that there is a man who is going to move in with these two women, but their very traditional landlord won't allow it unless he thinks that the man is gay.
Yes.
That's the whole point.
Yeah. It's just, it's ridiculous. It's, you know, now that we think about it, you know, again, this is something that you could probably go to, like, a major network nowadays and pitch something similar, and they would probably be fine with it. But yeah, back then, you know, people were probably like, oh, you're going to have somebody who's perceived as being gay on TV? Like, that's insane.
And because I mean, every episode of the show is basically the same. I used to watch the show a lot when I was a kid, but, like, every episode is basically the same, where the landlord thinks he's overhearing the roommates doing something naughty and dirty, but they're really just, like, hanging a shower curtain or cooking a turkey or something like that. Every single problem on every single episode could be solved with a post-it note.
Yes. It's like, hey, by the way, we're just hanging a shower curtain.
You can't have simple solutions on sitcoms. That's the whole point.
I also like the idea that someone could hang a shower curtain for, like, a half hour.
Like, realistically, it should take you, like, a few minutes, but, you know, because it's a sitcom, you know, there's some drama involved and whatever else. It's kind of funny because I've kind of gone on this, like, 80s sitcom kick or 90s sitcom kick, like, in the last few years. And I've never watched Three's Company, but I definitely watched stuff like News Radio and Frasier and whatnot. And I find it interesting to, yeah, like, you know, these very simple issues could all be resolved. But of course, you know, for the sake of filling out a 30-minute or hour-long show or whatever, they have to stretch it out, add some drama, some subplots.
They have to say some mildly suggestive things.
Yes. Just get those ratings.
Oh, yeah.
Final TV show we're going to talk about this week. Adaption of a movie, but Logan's Run. Yeah.
I don't know anything about this one.
Oh, really?
Really?
Well, it's kind of interesting because nowadays there's lots of movies that now people, you know, will adapt into a TV show. Like, for instance, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. ties into the movies and all that. But Logan's Run was sort of kind of like the real start of that. You know, Logan's Run, the movie, came out in 1976, was a very popular film at the time when it came out. And then 77, a year later, they came out with a one-hour weekly TV series. And it was only 14 episodes. It wasn't that long. But, I mean, I think when you look at the idea of taking a movie and adapting it for the television screen, I mean, it's definitely one that's more well known for having a successful transition, and especially, you know, in 1977 when these things weren't so common.
Yeah, that's an interesting progression.
Mm-hmm. Especially because Logan's Run, the movie, I've seen it. I think it's an interesting movie, but it's funny when you watch the show, like, obviously some production values kind of get lost in the transition, but generally speaking, it's not that different.
Interesting.
Yeah, anything from Carlos?
I'd only seen the film. I knew the television series existed, but I had never actually seen it. So did you say, so it wasn't an adaptation, it was a continuation, or it was an adaptation of the same story?
I think it was set in the universe. It wasn't quite a one-to-one.
So it was sort of like something of like an expanded universe material?
Yeah.
Because you mentioned Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., so I was going to say that would probably make this one of the sort of progenitors of that idea of having an expanded universe across multiple visual mediums, which is fairly innovative for a 1977 thing.
Yes. Yeah. And, it was a continuation, I'm fairly certain. Because
to go find that, be all like, oh, history. Yeah.
I know it's a... got a cult following, both the film and the TV show. A lot of people actually really enjoy both. So, and yeah, it's only 14 episodes. It might be hard to find because it's not exactly something that, you know, is on Netflix, I think, or anything like that. But if you can check it out, you should.
Yeah. I think it just may have been before its time.
Yes. I think a lot of these things kind of were. I mean, you look at stuff like Eraserhead that we talked about earlier and all that, and it's kind of like definitely odd things at the time that, you know, influence the next generation of filmmakers and whatnot.
Yeah, things that just the audience just wasn't ready to appreciate yet.
So, Carlos, I think we're going to wrap this up by giving 1977 a score on the Uncle Joey scale.
On the Uncle Joey scale, okay.
Yes. Now, Laura, we have a scale for reviewing things.
Okay.
And it's what we call the Uncle Joey scale. So, the barometrics for what the Uncle Joey scale is changes every time.
Okay.
So it's kind of hard to understand what it really means, but that's what kind of makes it partially
hard. Part charm is that the Uncle Joey scale literally doesn't make any goddamn sense.
There's no logic to it.
And is this based on Uncle Joey from Full House?
Yes.
Okay, so that makes perfect sense. I got it.
Finally, someone gets it.
Finally, someone understands. And yeah, like I was going to say, he just talked about, it's like I was on an 80s, 90s, like, come sort of thing. I'm like, all about Full House.
Everything. So I'm going to give 1977 a 600 out of 1,000 on the Uncle Joey scale.
Only, wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, it's Star Wars. It's some good stuff, but it's okay. It's a mediocre year, I guess, an average year. I think there's better years out there, Carlos. What are you going to give 1977, Carlos?
There's no choice. I have to give 1977 1 billion Uncle Joey's out of a billion.
That's impressive.
They like, had Star Wars. There's no other argument. It has to by default.
But see, 79 is Empire. So.
Oh. 80 is Empire. You don't even know what year these movies come out. He first thought that Star Wars came out in 79.
Yeah, I was like, I'm going to do this starting 1979, and Carlos was like...
imagine your first episode comes out, you don't even have the years right. They'll be like, this podcast is the worst.
Okay, to be fair, Carlos, I do the research week to week, so... And yes, you're right, 1980. Okay. Well... I'll have to have you back on, Carlos, for 1980, and then we'll have to see if your review changes because of Empire being there. Okay, and Laura, being the special guest, do you have a rating for 1977?
Sure. This is because of The Spy Who Loved Me, which, as I said, is my favorite James Bond film, and I'm a huge James Bond nerd, and because of Rumors, I will give 1977 out of 2,000 Uncle Joey's.
Ooh, wow. That's a great score.
See what she did there.
That's very clever.
He's already
I feel like we should put that on a box quote or something.
What's that?
I said we should put that as like a box quote or something.
Oh, yeah.
1977 out of 2,000, Uncle Joey's, Laura.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Okay. I'll rate this podcast 2,000 out of 2,000, Uncle Joey's, though.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
High praise.
It's mainly because of that sick intro sequence, really.
Oh, definitely.
That was probably 1,800 of the Uncle Joey's right there.
Totally.
Which, by the way, you know, because I'm sure listeners are going to be like, how do they know what it sounds like? I said that before, because we've referenced things like that before, and our listeners are like, how do they know what it sounds like? I'm like, I sent it to them, guys. They know. So before we leave, let us plug some stuff. See, we're still on our game here.
Nice.
Go check out Laura's podcast, the Lettuce Podcast.
Yes, please.
You know, I've listened to it, and as someone who's listened to it, I have to say, if you listen to Three Angry Nerds, this is pretty much what I've been saying for years. This is like the female equivalent of Three Angry Nerds.
Yeah, I did. I listened to the episode that Curtis sent me, and yes. I was all like, wow, these people are totally doing the same stuff that we do. It's just that they're women. This is great.
I'm no, so touched is. That you guys like it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's always good to kind of get different opinions and whatnot. I think our listeners at least would, you know, probably enjoy listening to the podcast to hear what you and Charlotte and your other guests have to say.
Yeah.
Listen to our main podcast, the Three Angry Nerds podcast, as well as our offshoot, the dating advice show, Nerds in Love.
I really enjoyed that one, by the way.
Or did you listen to Nerds in Love?
Yeah, I've been going back through your catalog because, yes, we're very similar, so naturally I'm enjoying it. But the most recent Nerds in Love, I really enjoyed.
And the thing with that is, you know, we just get these emails. The whole thing about that when it started was that we were getting so many dating advice emails on the regular show. We're like, well, we're getting enough of these. We could do like a 30-minute offshoot. And I've been surprised at how well it sustained itself. I was kind of thinking we would probably, you know, see a slowdown in emails, but that's never really happened.
We usually are able to get at least 5 emails a week for Nerds in Love, if not more. So it's like, it's crazy.
And most of them are like an epic essay at the very least.
Or yeah, we get novels.
Yeah, it seemed that way.
You know, go read Doom's fan fiction.
Yay.
Is there like a certain... Well, I always link to it, Carlos, but, you know, you can go check it out on comicbookmovie.com.
Or on fanfiction.net.
Yes, also too on Alternative Earths, right?
And it's also, yes, now on Alternative Earths as well. So it has 3 places where you can find it. So there's no excuse.
And I'll say, you know, it's very long for me to read, so I have Megan read all of your fan fiction to me when we're going to bed. It's like our going to bed ritual. But from what I've heard, it's great. I guess that's it, really. See you guys next week as we visit 1978.
And now we know that Curtis can count.
Yay. Yes.
Because that was true. Up in the air, to be honest.
That was a real stickler point for this podcast, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.